Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
As a Canadian journalist and foreign correspondent, I've covered protests all over the world, but I've never witnessed anything quite like the pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong in the summer of 2019.
反送中，抗惡法，抗惡法，撤回收緊引渡條例。
By the time I arrived to report on the protests for Global News, Hong Kongers had already been gathering by the thousands for months to protest against the government's proposed extradition bill. It would have allowed Hong Kong residents who are facing charges to be extradited to mainland China, which has a conviction rate of 99%. Protesters feared Beijing would use the legislation to prosecute its political opponents in Hong Kong. And so they gathered again and again to voice their opposition. On August the 18th, 2019, I watched nearly 2 million people, a quarter of the city's population, march through the streets. And I interviewed one of the most prominent members of the pro-democracy movement, a then 22-year-old named Joshua Wong.
In the recent rally, we have 2 million people. We show that how unity and solidarity, from the generation of baby boomers to millennials, from youngster to elderly, from grassroots to upper class elite, all we join the strike with solidarity and unity with our cause on democracy and freedom.
By September 2019, it appeared the pro-democracy movement had won a major victory. The Hong Kong government withdrew the extradition bill. The protesters were filled with hope. Well, what a difference a couple of years can make.
We begin with that breaking news where in Beijing, where China's parliament has reportedly passed a controversial national security law for Hong Kong.
Dozens of pro-democracy advocates were rounded up in simultaneous police raids.
Hong Kong democracy activist Joshua Wong has been arrested.
I'm Jeff Semple, senior correspondent for Global News, and this is China Rising. Episode 7, Hong Kong. To understand what's happening in Hong Kong today and why it matters to all of us, I need to very quickly take you back in time to 1997. On the night of June 30th, 1997, British and Chinese soldiers marched together in a ceremony at the Hong Kong Convention and Exhibition Center. The Union Jack was lowered, and the Chinese flag was raised in its place. At midnight, the British government officially handed over responsibility for Hong Kong to the People's Republic of China, marking the end of 156 years of British rule. But there was a catch. Hong Kong's handover agreement included a constitutional guarantee of special status for Hong Kong. It's called One Country, Two Systems. Chapter 1, Article 5 of the Hong Kong Constitution reads, "The socialist system and policies shall not be practiced in the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, and the previous capitalist system and way of life shall remain unchanged for 50 years. Under the agreement, Hong Kong would essentially maintain its autonomy, except in matters of foreign affairs and national defense. It also guaranteed Hong Kongers would continue to enjoy democratic freedoms and human rights, including freedoms of speech, assembly, and the press. Hong Kong was to be an oasis of civil liberties living in the shadow of authoritarianism. At the handover ceremony, Prince Charles gave a speech signaling hope for the future.
Britain is part of Hong Kong's history, and Hong Kong is part of Britain's history. We are also part of each other's future. We are confident that the ties between us will not only endure, but will continue to develop.
And for a time, they did. Hong Kong prospered as one of the world's major financial hubs, nicknamed Asia's World City, a capitalist gateway connecting communist China to the Western world. And as I mentioned, under the terms of the handover, that one country, two systems arrangement was to last for 50 years until 2047. But today, you'd almost never know it.
But right now, it's quite dire.
That's JC. He and his wife are Canadians from Montreal. They've been living in Hong Kong for 12 years. I first met the couple back in 2019 when I was sent to Hong Kong to cover the protests against that proposed extradition bill. JC and his wife were there, fighting for their adopted home.
They must be supported. They must be helped in keeping the life that they've been having up to now.
The protests against the extradition law began in March of 2019 with a sit-in at the government headquarters. And the demonstrations continued every week for months and grew larger. By June, hundreds of thousands of people were taking to the streets. On June 15th, the government agreed to suspend the extradition bill. But the protests continued, with demonstrators demanding the law be withdrawn completely. Then, in August, things turned ugly. Scenes of violence were broadcast around the world as protesters clashed with police at Hong Kong's international airport. It was a bad look for the pro-democracy movement. The violence threatened to undermine its public support, both at home and abroad. A lot of ordinary Hong Kongers who supported peaceful protests were embarrassed and angry. And some expected the pro-democracy movement might finally fizzle out. Just days after the violence at the airport, on August 18, 2019, pro-democracy leaders organized another rally. My Global News cameraman, Darren Twiss, and I arrived early that day wearing our protective gear, helmets, and gas masks, not sure what to expect or if anyone would even show up. But then they did. An estimated 1.7 million people. Police had denied the organizers' request to hold a march through the city, instructing the group instead to gather in a local park. But as the crowd swelled, the park quickly reached capacity, and police had no choice but to let the demonstration spill into the streets. Suddenly, dark clouds rolled in overhead, and it started to pour. But the protesters, undeterred, marched on. At one point, my cameraman and I managed to climb up some stairs to get a better view. Below us was a sea of umbrellas, people clogging every inch of every street in all directions as far as we could see. The crowds were so dense that you could barely move. And besides the pouring rain, it was also swelteringly hot. Everyone was soaked. But Hong Kongers, young and old, marched on for hours, from the early afternoon till the evening. And they did so peacefully.
things do flare up sometimes, but generally you see that it's still quite peaceful. The behavior of the protesters are quite polite.
That's Michael Zhang. He's a freelance journalist from Vancouver who has lived in Hong Kong for the past 5 years. When I met him in the summer of 2019, he told me that after months of demonstrations, the pro-democracy protesters had refined their craft. After the violence at the airport, for example, which resulted in public anger, the organizers produced a written apology.
You know, after what happened at the airport, they rethought their strategy a bit. I saw from the online groups, chat groups, they were doing a poll to see, oh, should we apologize tomorrow? And I think it's like 80% voted in favor that yes, we should apologize. So it's really interesting to see. Like, it's very fluid and dynamic how the protests are happening.
While we were reporting on the protests, we would arrive with our protective gear. But for the most part, instead of rocks and tear gas, we were met with bottles of water and snacks. An army of volunteers constantly offered us free drink and food, and they would thank us over and over for coming to report on the protests. If an ambulance or another emergency vehicle needed to get through the sea of protesters, people at the front would signal and the crowds would instantly part, shuffling to the sides of the street to make room for the vehicle to pass. Some protesters were even spotted occasionally cleaning and mopping up after their demonstrations.
Well, they definitely want to maintain the image that it's a peaceful protest, because at the end of the day, if things do get violent on the protester side, they will lose a lot of support, not just from international community, but also from, you know, Hong Kong. There's some locals who are more moderate. So it's definitely something that they seem to be aware of.
We would often see Canadian flags flying at the protests, in part because demonstrators were trying to rally the international community to their cause, but also because in the crowds, there were a lot of Canadians. Hong Kong is home to around 300,000 Canucks, the largest number in any city anywhere in the world outside of Canada. And one of them became the pro-democracy campaign's most recognizable voice. Denise Ho grew up in Quebec, but the 44-year-old is a household name in Hong Kong. Ho is a Cantonese pop, or Cantopop, music superstar. When I met her at one of the protests, she was immediately swarmed by fans asking for selfies and autographs.
There was a... There is a huge outcome of the march today. I am feeling very, very proud of Hong Kongers today, because we have once again proved that, first of all, we are peaceful. If there is no police, there is no violence. That is what we have proved today. And also, we have proved our flexibility and our ability to overcome all these challenges that have been thrown into our way by the Hong Kong and the Beijing government.
Ho was born in Hong Kong, but moved to Montreal as a child in 1988. She first developed a taste for activism during the Quebec referendum in 1995. The following year, she returned to Hong Kong to take part in the New Talent Singing Awards. It's an annual televised contest, sort of like Hong Kong's version of American Idol. Much to her surprise, Ho won the contest, and she chose to remain in Hong Kong to pursue her musical career. Eventually, she became one of the city's biggest pop stars and activists. In 2012, she was the first Hong Kong celebrity to come out as a lesbian. She later became a director of Stand News, a pro-democracy digital news outlet. And a couple of years ago, Ho even addressed the United Nations, calling for China to be removed from the Human Rights Council, despite being interrupted a couple of times by a Chinese diplomat.
China is denying its obligations. The one country, two systems is nearing its death. Protests are still ongoing.
There is a point of order. I give the floor to China.
For her efforts, Ho has faced both arrest and significant commercial backlash. But she's soldiered on, marching among the crowds at protest after protest, calling on the international community, including her former home and native land, to stand on guard for Hong Kong.
Well, really, I think this is a very global issue that we are facing. There is not enough pressure from whether it's the Canadian government or even the British or everywhere. I think I can understand that the economy and the economic side of things, where countries they are tied with China on the financial side, and then somehow people these governments, they might think that there is not much they can do, but we are this global community, and if countries came together to deal with the situation, then I think there are things that can be done.
Western leaders seemed reluctant to get involved, but many voiced their support for the peaceful protests in Hong Kong. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he was extremely concerned about the situation in Hong Kong and called for authorities there to listen to the very serious concerns brought forward by Chinese citizens. A few weeks after that massive protest in August 2019, the Hong Kong government finally bowed to public pressure and formally withdrew the extradition bill. A couple of months later, in November, Hong Kong held local elections, which resulted in a stunning victory.
The pro-democracy opposition in Hong Kong is celebrating a landslide victory in local elections. Almost 3 million people, a record 71% of voters, went to the polls yesterday. Pro-democracy candidates won 80% of the contested district council seats.
Denise Ho says that record voter turnout was thanks in large part to a surge of young Hong Kongers who had also been a major force behind the demonstrations in the 6 months leading up to the election. 73% of voters under the age of 35 cast a ballot, the highest of any age group.
I am so proud of our young generation because they have been leading us into these protests with the courage, with their fearlessness in face of the all kinds of police brutality that we have been seeing. And so, personally, I'm choosing to stand by them and stand with them because they are safeguarding the future of Hong Kong, which is something that we should have done.
But after months of pro-democracy protests and that stunning election result in 2019, the Chinese Communist Party had seen enough.
And then Beijing stepped in.
That's JC again, the Hong Kong resident from Montreal, whom we heard from earlier. When I first met him in 2019, he and many other protesters were happy to provide their names and show their faces for interviews. But not anymore. JC asked us not to reveal his last name, pointing to Hong Kong's new national security law, which he says changed everything.
It crystallized the fact that we had reached a point of no return.
China's national security law went into effect on July 1st, 2020. And it dramatically expanded the Chinese central government's powers in Hong Kong. The law covers four key areas of criminal activity: secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign or external forces. Immediately, some Hong Kongers feared the law would empower authorities to arrest anyone who criticized the Chinese government. But the activists' response to the legislation was complicated by COVID-19. JC says the pandemic provided cover for Beijing to usher in the new legislation without worrying about sparking mass protests or even elections.
At the end of 2019 and into 2020, right, we got into COVID, and this actually gave a very good excuse for the government to start like clamping down on any kind of mass gathering. And then what was a big sign is that there was supposed to be elections, which were postponed. And the argument then was that we will postpone the elections because of COVID. And then little that we knew then is that it was actually to fully implement those NSL measures.
The National Security Law, or NSL, also spawned the creation of a new Chinese security agency in Hong Kong, which was empowered to investigate cases and bring defendants to trial on the mainland. Those convicted under the NSL face maximum sentences of life imprisonment. But China's foreign ministry said it would only be used to target very few criminals. The arrests began almost immediately.
July 1st, 2020 may be the day Hong Kong's autonomous bubble finally burst.
Hong Kong's new security law is in full force with arrests and a very heavy police presence on the ground. Police, in fact, have already detained at least 300 people since the law took effect 24 hours ago.
First, police rounded up pro-democracy politicians and activists like Joshua Wong.
23-year-old Wong is the latest in a string of activists being charged after last year's pro-democracy protests.
Then they came for the journalists. In June, 500 police officers raided the newsroom of Hong Kong's Apple Daily tabloid newspaper, known for its brash and critical coverage of Beijing. Some of its reporters were arrested. The paper's owner is now serving several prison sentences in connection with the 2019 protests.
This is the first time where media articles are being cited as potential violations of this national security law.
Chinese government officials said the publication had abused so-called freedom of the press.
A victim of tyranny. That was the defiant cover story of the last ever edition of the Apple Daily, as Hong Kong's final pro-democracy newspaper wrote its own obituary.
Denise Ho, the Canadian Hong Kong pop star, was also forced to resign her director position at Stand News. And that news site had to remove all previously published articles. In July of 2021, authorities even arrested the authors of a children's book called Defenders of Sheep Village. It explores the politics of a protest movement using sheep and big bad wolves. JC was stunned.
The clampdown just increased. You could feel it like every week it was something new, right?
In all, more than 60 people were charged under the new security law in its first year, sending a message to the rest of the city.
The scrutiny is much, much higher right now, and the reach is much, much broader as well, right? I mean, because I think they will use all the strength of the state, you know, to snuff out any kind of dissent.
Some, like former Hong Kong politician and activist Nathan Law, managed to escape the country in the middle of the night.
I took a night flight. I had to leave home with a backpack and with a small luggage. And by the time, I couldn't even say goodbye with my family. And by the time the plane was taxiing and it was leaving the ground, when I looked back to the city, I realized that could be the very last time.
Law is now living in exile in the United Kingdom. He says he's had to cut off all contact with his family back home in Hong Kong.
Well, it's difficult for me to have contact with them because that could endanger them. They could be accused of assisting my work, my advocacy work, or colluding with foreign forces. And for now, as I'm in exile due to Beijing's hunting, I need to continue to voice for Hong Kong people and continue to do the international awareness raising work that Hong Kong people cannot do in Hong Kong.
In January 2021, the British government introduced a new visa that allows many Hong Kong residents, like Nathan Law, to move to the UK. Britain estimates that about 300,000 Hong Kongers will accept the offer, which the government said is necessary because China is undermining Hong Kong's rights and freedoms. The Canadian government also opened new pathways to permanent residency for Hong Kongers who have previously worked or studied in Canada.
Canada joins the international community in expressing its grave concern.
Canada is already home to more than 200,000 Hong Kong-born residents. But those expats and Canada's Chinese community appeared divided over Hong Kong's future. Back in October 2019, as Hong Kong was in the midst of that election campaign that saw a surge of young voters, protests were also happening an ocean away in Canada. Hundreds of Hong Kong pro-democracy supporters gathered in Richmond, British Columbia, near Vancouver. At one point, they were taunted by a small group of opponents, and tensions erupted. Police intervened and arrested one of the Hong Kong protest supporters.
We have a fermentation in our Chinese community.
That's Patrick Louis. He's a Canadian who lives in BC and is proudly pro-Beijing.
I think Hong Kong's destiny is tied to China. And no amount of foreign interference will be able to change that.
Louis moved from Hong Kong to Canada in 1977. Over the past four decades, he's raised a family, completed a PhD in computer science, and worked in high tech for 35 years before retiring a few years ago. He still has friends and family in Hong Kong, but until recently, he says, he felt it was too dangerous to visit. He believes the new national security law was desperately needed.
Because what Hong Kong was like before was terrible. And we think that this law would actually finally restore the peace and calm.
Louis considers the pro-democracy protests to be riots. And he points to the numerous examples, particularly in the fall of 2019, when they turned violent. In October 2019, a few weeks before Hong Kong's elections, tens of thousands marched once again through the streets of the city. But authorities denied permission for the protest and responded with tear gas. Some protesters then threw firebombs at police and attacked suspected pro-Beijing businesses. The situation spiraled out of control. At another demonstration a month later, a scuffle broke out between a police officer and a protester. And the officer started shooting.
Wait.
A 21-year-old was shot in the stomach, but survived. That same day, another horrific incident saw a man arguing with a group of protesters. One of them responded by apparently dousing him with gas and setting him on fire. Patrick Louis, the BC resident from Hong Kong, says that violence forced Beijing's hand and necessitated the new national security law.
Despicable rioters that we in the West touted as freedom and democracy fighters, whose freedom of speech is basically, I speak, you obey. I think what Western media has done, you know, in Western media and politician, the strategy of trying to divide China by instigating a discontent in Hong Kong is really failing, right? The hypocrisy and the bias just backfired. And I think Hong Kong and China are more united now than ever.
You've talked a lot about these rioters. But most of the people I met who were protesting, and you know, at one point there were almost 2 million of them, most of them were not rioting. They were protesting peacefully.
Even if there were 2 million people, a lot of them has their change of heart already. Now, like I have I know a university professor who was in that protest, and then now he's actually close CCP. Can you imagine? people change minds when they actually are presented with facts.
Louis believes the majority of ordinary Hong Kongers have come around and now support Beijing and its national security law. He points to an opinion poll conducted just after the legislation took effect in July 2020, which was widely touted by the Chinese government. It found 66% of Hong Kongers supported the security law. Now, that poll was conducted by a group called the Hong Kong Public Opinion Research Institute, which Chinese state media describes as a non-profit opinion survey organization. Little information about that association is publicly available, but local media reports have claimed it has close ties to the Chinese government. And its poll result stands in sharp contrast to another poll commissioned by Reuters, the UK-based news agency. At around the same time, it found 60% of Hong Kongers were in fact opposed to the new law.
It's very hard to say.
JC, the Montrealer living in Hong Kong, says it's difficult to gauge the true public sentiment because people who oppose Beijing are now afraid to say so.
When you cut all the means for the population to express themselves, it's very hard to say. But one thing for sure, it has certainly polarized.
In November of 2020, police opened a hotline for Hong Kong residents to report suspected violations of the security law, basically a snitch line, which received more than 100,000 messages in 6 months.
Within our friends, I mean, we get both sides of the camps. And yes, it makes some discussions that we will avoid, let's say, right, if we want to keep the friendship. And then for myself, there's some people that I've just written off. I mean, there's some level of discourse that I will not tolerate.
JC and his wife recently decided they'd had enough. When I first met the couple in 2019, they said they planned to stay and to continue to fight. But now they're making plans to move back to Canada.
How difficult is the decision? Very difficult because, as I was mentioning, my wife's parents are here, all of her family. And why I personally fought for Hong Kong is I think that it's certainly the most interesting place I've been in the world, and the people are great, and you know, we had a good 12 years here, right? So it makes it really difficult, right? But at one point, it's just there's so much that we have values that we stand for, and like working and living in what I consider now being like part of the greater Chinese dictatorship? No, never, never.
Some Western businesses are also eyeing the exit. Since the national security law was introduced, the government says the number of overseas firms with offices in Hong Kong has remained steady at about 9,000, and capital continues to flow into the city. But a recent survey by the American Chamber of Commerce found more than 40% of respondents were considering or planning to leave Hong Kong. The chamber collected 325 anonymous responses for the survey, about a quarter of its membership. But Beijing doesn't seem too bothered. For decades, mainland China relied on Hong Kong's economic engine, but not anymore. The city's output is now less than 3% of the mainland's. Hong Kong's office towers, recently vacated by some foreign banks, are now being filled by Chinese state-owned companies.
We kind of suffer, we kind of depressed, we kind of exhausted right now.
That's Canadian Ian Chan, again, not his real name. He works in Hong Kong's financial services sector and is planning to stay put for now, but he says many of his colleagues are leaving.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Yeah, I have... Yeah, I sent off like quite a few friends at the airport this year already. Some of my friends are leaving back to Canada, going to the UK, moving to Australia. I've been kind of visiting the airport for this reason. Many of them are actually my friends. They are some of my colleagues from my university as well. And yes, even my superior as well in my company, they all move. Many of them are fear for the situation in Hong Kong, the political atmosphere.
Hong Kong's dual identity was never meant to last forever. Its days as a semi-autonomous city were always numbered. But that countdown is supposed to be 26 years in the future. Under the terms of the handover agreement, Beijing doesn't officially take control of Hong Kong until 2047. But JC says with each passing day, the border between Hong Kong and the mainland fades faster.
I think that we reach a point where, you know, most people are just, you know, even the activists, right? They say they understand now that the battle cannot be in Hong Kong because it's lost essentially, right? So the only thing that you can do, and I think that the activists that have left, good for them, right? Good for them. There's no point dying in a fight that you cannot win. But I think the battle has been fought, and the world has seen Hong Kong stand up. They have seen 2 million people in the streets, and that will stay, right? And maybe one day, there will be another opportunity. But right now, it's quite dire.
Some observers fear Hong Kong is merely an appetizer, that Beijing has its sights set on reclaiming another territory. But this one risks igniting a world war.
Issuing a stern warning to Beijing, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that United States is concerned about China's aggressive actions against Taiwan.
The Chinese government has a detailed strategy to reclaim Taiwan and to overtake the United States as the world's dominant power by the year 2049. But some experts warn the situation may come to a head much sooner.
In terms of the military power to effectuate an invasion of Taiwan, I think the Chinese Communist Party has built that many times over.
Taiwan believes Beijing is preparing for war. The Chinese military recently released this video of Chinese drills simulating amphibious assaults. And almost every day, Chinese jets cross Taiwan's self-identified airspace defense identification zone. Never before have so many Chinese planes come so close to Taiwan.
We'll separate fact from fear-mongering next time on China Rising. This podcast is written and produced by me, Jeff Semple, with producer Dila Velezquez. Audio editing and sound design is by Rob Johnston. Editing assistance from Stephanie D'Souza. You can help me share this podcast by telling a friend, and don't forget to rate and review China Rising on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can find me on Twitter at JeffSempleGN, and you can email me at jeff.semple@globalnews.ca. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time on China Rising.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.